Chapter 15, Austria, 1935. It was 1935, and Austria was still several years from being annexed by the growing menace of Nazi Germany. Since 1930, outbreaks of diphtheria had been raging. Although mortality had fallen as medical care had improved, the number of children coming down with white leathery patches on their throat and tongue had skyrocketed. Years earlier, Austria, like many other countries, had suffered a devastating blow in its attempt to control the bacterial infection. A faulty batch of the toxin-antitoxin mixture had killed 6 infants, an accident that shocked the country so profoundly the government banned the use of diphtheria injections. With thousands of children coming down with infections and word that a safer version of the formula was being utilized in America, Austrian health officials decided to capitalize on the public's fear by introducing the new alum precipitated shot. Because of the high rate of serum sickness from the previous version of the vaccine, any product which could potentially work with fewer injections was highly regarded. The formula was produced in-house and contained a slight modification from the previous alum precipitated mixtures. Instead of the potassium aluminum that was being used elsewhere, they would employ aluminum hydroxide, another white powder that appeared to have the same immune-boosting effects. Aluminum hydroxide had what seemed to be an advantage over its predecessor. It didn't create the same aggressive abscesses and granulomas that plagued the earlier aluminum-precipitated diphtheria shots. There were still the occasional hard red arms after the injections, but thankfully, decidedly fewer. While this was certainly an improvement in pain management from the injection, the body was no longer as aggressive at protecting itself from the foreign material. In other words, the aluminum hydroxide was being absorbed into the bloodstream, into the lymphatic system. In the Austrian capital of Vienna, soon after the new aluminum-containing diphtheria shot was instituted, a psychiatrist began to document an unusual set of behaviors in some of the children anxious parents had brought him. The first patient the doctor mentioned, Fritz, had a distinct, faraway gaze that would not meet whomever attempted to make eye contact with him. He was very clumsy and unable to make friends with any of the children at school. Like Alfred, the boy Connor had seen in Baltimore, he would occasionally utter phrases that seemed both childish and remarkably adult-like at the same time. More often than not, Fritz would disregard anything asked of him, sitting in complete silence only to leap up without the slightest provocation and fling everything off the table sitting in front of him. Another child, Haro, displayed the same lost gaze and was often uninterested in answering questions posed to him. Other times, he could respond with answers that were almost comically profound. Describing a bush, he said, quote, "The bush. That is where the branches grow straight off the ground, completely jumbled up, so that it can happen that 3 or 4 cross over each other so that one has a knot in one's hand." End quote. Both suffered from a pronounced clumsiness that made participation in nearly any childhood game the source for more ridicule. Other children were brought to his Vienna office and exhibited the same peculiar behaviors. A distinct lack of self-awareness led them to wield their command of language as a weapon, smiting anyone who made them feel uncomfortable. When asked a general question about charities, one responded, quote, "They do things for unfortunate people. They provide wheelchairs, stilts, and round shoes for people with no feet," end quote. Another described a hole in a sock as, quote, "a temporary loss of knitting," end quote. Other, more disturbing patterns emerged from some of the children. An absolute reliance on routine, so much so that if anything was misplaced, such as a treasured pair of socks, or if any part of a daily schedule was deviated from in the slightest, such as a gathering for breakfast or the sighting of the mailman, complete mental breakdown could occur. The children exhibiting these behaviors could not be reasoned with, no matter what threats were leveraged against them, such was their fear. As a result, their families had become shells of their former selves, consigned to a life of rhythm and routine designed solely to appease the severely disturbed children in their midst. This trait could sometimes surface as an obsession with things, objects of little consequence, collected ad nauseam and arranged in groupings so specific that an affected child could instantly notice 1 out of 100 rotated a quarter turn from where they were originally placed. Toys or dolls, the typical playthings of childhood, seemed to have no interest to them, not in the imaginative sense at least. Assemblies of rocks, tens, or ashtrays, however, might offer endless fascination. A final puzzling trait emerged after having seen several of these children: extraordinary computational skills. Without any notable instruction, some of them were able to perform remarkable mathematic feats, instantly calculating complex problems that would stump most any adult. When asked to describe how they were able to answer these problems so easily, their answers often revealed overly complicated multi-step operations that should have taken much longer than the tried-and-true techniques being taught in school. Despite the intricate solutions they had seemingly conjured out of thin air, they were often able to best the efforts of any of their peers. The Austrian doctor was stumped. The children exhibited behaviors unlike anything he had ever seen, but could clearly be grouped together in a constellation of peculiar behaviors. Unable to label the disorder, he began to describe the children as autistic, the name of a symptom used to describe the aloneness and isolation common to schizophrenia. His choice of autistic was an utterly insufficient descriptor for these children who suffered from so many different things. But it would not matter. As more and more parents began to bring their troubled children into his office, the clouds of war began to gather over the country. Germany would soon take possession of Austria as its prize, and scientific collaboration between the West and the motherland would come to a complete halt. For now, no one outside of Austria or Germany would know a thing about Hans Asperger and the 200 cases of children he began documenting in 1935. Back in North America, acceptance of the new diphtheria vaccine was not going as well as was hoped. Parents had grown accustomed to the three-shot series and didn't trust a single dose to do the job. Health officials badly needed a prominent spokesperson who could galvanize the public's belief in the safety and effectiveness of the new diphtheria shot. The March of Dimes would engage U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to help collect research money in its battle with polio. The aluminum-containing diphtheria shot, however, would make use of a very special physician, a humble country doctor from Canada, and the five little girls whose lives he was credited with saving.